that lovable little girl with the red dress, the curly hair, the big dog, and the even bigger voice is back. The sun will come out tomorrow, so you gotta... This time, though, Annie is back with a difference. Actress Kavenjanae Wallace, who is African-American, is playing the iconic orphan in an ethnically diverse, up-to-date world. And her arrival has our critic Bob Mondello thinking about other instances where producers have breathed fresh life into familiar shows by making them dance to a new beat.
In the late 1960s, after 1,500 performances, Broadway's Hello, Dolly! Was still arguably glowin' and crowin', but was no longer goin' strong. Carol Channing had long since departed with a touring company, and her first three replacements on The Great White Way, Ginger Rogers, Betty Grable, and Martha Ray, had been playing to ever-diminishing crowds. Newer shows like Man of La Mancha and Cabaret were making Dolly seem old hat. Then producer David Merrick figured out how to make Dolly the freshest face on the block. He hired not just a new star, but a whole new cast. A whole new black cast at the height of the civil rights movement. Pearl Bailey, Cab Calloway, even a youngster named Morgan Freeman making his Broadway debut. And suddenly, his tired old war horse looked new again. Merrick was clear about one thing. This bright cartoon of a show was still a celebration of Yonkers, not Harlem. African-American only in casting, not in sensibility. What you saw with Pearl Bailey was what you'd seen with Carol Channing, and that seemed to please audiences who lined up round the block. Recasting an established show with performers of color was not a new idea in 1967. Broadway had done it before, though usually working a few changes on the original to justify the casting. Producer Billy Rose, for instance, was envious when Porgy and Bess became a huge success in the 1930s for one of his competitors. How could he get a piece of that action? Maybe by adapting the opera Carmen for a black Broadway cast. He hired Oscar Hammerstein, fresh from writing lyrics for Oklahoma, to move the story from 19th century Spain to the segregated American South, where the leading lady, now named Carmen Jones, worked in a World War II parachute factory. Happily, she still sang music by Georges Bizet.
Love's a baby that grows up wild, and he won't do what you want him to. Love ain't nobody's angel child, and he won't pay any mind to you.
Carmen Jones qualified as a thoughtful reworking of its source material in terms of story, but not all producers have the patience for that. Some just update the orchestrations. A revival of Guys and Dolls in the 1970s started out with Broadway brass, but quickly let you know it was a disco-era staging partly financed by Motown. Didn't take long for audiences to figure out that was not a good idea. Other revivals, though, have taken far greater liberties. Gilbert and Sullivan's Mikado, for instance, had always sounded like this.
Three little maids who all unwary come from a lady's seminary, free from seniors to Tulare. Three little maids from school.
Then in the 1930s, an all-black swing Mikado and a mostly black hot Mikado started bopping to a different beat. Call this a case of cultural bait and switch, if you like, but note that it does not seriously alter the original, at least not the way Romeo and Juliet was altered when it was both musicalized and Hispanicized as West Side Story. Leaving the script alone, but hiring actors of color to play roles that usually go to white performers, non-traditional casting, has long been a stage tradition, not just in musicals, but in straight plays, too. One that put a 20-year-old kid named Orson Welles on the map when he first leapt from acting to directing, with a production that became known as his Voodoo Macbeth.
Play on, Macduff! Let them be he who first tries, hold enough!
When Wells reimagined Shakespeare's Scottish tragedy in a Caribbean jungle, he envisioned a stage full of so many black characters that New York didn't have enough professional black actors to play them all. Didn't matter, even with a largely amateur cast, the show electrified audiences and got raves from all but one of the city's major critics. The one pan, though, by the Herald Tribune's Percy Hammond, apparently distressed the cast, prompting one of the show's African drummers to lay an elaborate voodoo curse on the reviewer. Wells reportedly found this amusing until Hammond dropped dead of a heart attack 48 hours later.
And be these juggling fiends no more believed.
Happier reviews, and happily no deaths, have greeted non-Shakespearean examples of non-traditional casting. James Earl Jones playing Big Daddy in Cat on a Hot Tin Roof, Ruby Dee as the matriarch in an African-American glass menagerie. And what works on stage has also worked on screen. Rob Lowe and Jim Belushi were buddies in the film comedy About Last Night in 1986.
You know what your problem is? Your face. You're too good-looking. Best thing that happened to you, Danny, is an industrial accident.
Flash forward a couple of decades to earlier this year with Michael Ealy and Kevin Hart headlining and updated About Last Night.
You know what your problem is? You're too damn good looking.
What?
Best thing that can happen to your face is an industrial accident.
The new one is set in Los Angeles and is a raucous good time, which the sweeter, sultrier Chicago-based original mostly was not. Different strokes, as it were, and proof that Hollywood can work some interesting variations on the remake game, which is certainly what's happening in the updated Annie. The new version isn't just pleasantly diverse in its casting, it's been pretty thoroughly rethought. Little things like including recycling in the orphanage cleanup number, A Hard Knock Life. Bigger things like having Annie's benefactor be not a disinterested Daddy Warbucks, but a billionaire turned politician who's been told by his campaign manager that the photogenic foster kid will bring him higher poll numbers.
So what's the hustle?
The more we're seen together, the better it is for my campaign.
I bet if I moved in with you, you'd become president.
In short, this is not just a matter of changing the racial makeup of a few characters. Yes, there is non-traditional casting going on, and no, the new Annie is not a full-fledged rewrite like The Wiz was of Wizard of Oz. Instead, it occupies an intriguing middle ground, teasing new values from a show that had once traded mostly in nostalgia. What kind of new values? Well, specifically smart ones. The story now starts in a classroom and ends with the founding of a literacy center. How's that for a declaration that the intent is to smarten things up? And by listing Jay-Z as one of their producers, the filmmakers are also signaling that their smartening will not sound like warmed over Broadway. I'm Bob Mandela.
For some listeners, perhaps millions of you, this theme music is a siren song pulling you into one of the most popular podcasts probably ever, Serial. It's a true crime story produced by the folks who brought you This American Life. Producer Sarah Koenig and her team spent the last year examining the 1999 murder conviction of a Baltimore County teen accused of strangling his ex-girlfriend. He's currently serving a life sentence in a Maryland prison. Koenig's podcast has spawned a massive and arguably obsessive following. Internet message boards like Reddit pick apart the episodes for clues. There are not one, but two podcasts about the podcast, and Koenig herself has landed squarely in the public eye. Sarah Koenig, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
If you could start by giving us just a brief synopsis of the case itself, what prosecutors alleged in the case.
The state's case was that a 17-year-old high school senior named Adnan Syed had strangled his ex-girlfriend one day after school in January of 1999. They had a witness who said that he helped Adnan Syed bury this body. So that was their case.
And as you mentioned, Adnan Syed is the man who was convicted for the crime. The victim was Haman Lee. What aspects of this case did you think were worth exploring further?
When I first learned about the case from a friend of Adnan's family, she really came to believe he didn't do this. And she saw so many weaknesses in this case. There's no eyewitnesses to the actual murder. There's really no physical evidence linking Adnan to the crime itself. So I wanted to understand what the state understood. I was just like, well, I don't understand what this, how they made this case. So let me figure out how they made this case. So that was the big question to me.
And you spent a year on this, right?
I spent more than a year on it. I first heard about it 2 summers ago and started looking into it in September of 2013 in a kind of more serious way, and then turned to it full time last January.
And you interview family, you interview friends, you go through cell phone logs from the time. I mean, you're totally transparent about what you do or don't know, but also how you're feeling at any given time. For instance, in interviews with Adnan Syed, he calls you from prison. And here's a sample from one of those calls where he asks basically why you're interested in the case.
My interest in it, honestly, has been you. Like, you're a really nice guy. Like, I like talking to you, you know? So then it's kind of like this question of, well, what does that mean, you know?
Yeah. Oh, I mean, you don't even really know me, though, Tony. Maybe you do. Maybe, I mean, you know, I don't, we only talk on the phone. I don't understand what you mean.
So he sounds puzzled by your interest. You know, how much did you worry that you were being kind of emotionally captured by him, right? Like, listening back, do you think you did a good enough job policing yourself?
I think I did a good job policing myself. Yeah. I mean, and I'm definitely susceptible to that. I mean, there's no question. I like Adnan. I mean, I do. Like, he's a likable person. And, you know, I know him. I know him a bit.
But every time you say, I like him, I think there's like a bunch of people out there who think, wait, journalists aren't supposed to say that.
But I think that's a fake. I think that's fake. I think that if journalists, reporters who spend a lot of time on a story are honest with themselves, we all have feelings about ourselves. I mean, unless you're a robot, you know, but I just feel like, of course, we have feelings about the people we cover. And I just think the most important thing is to catch yourself, be aware of how you're feeling and have checks on it. And that was crucial.
This is the part of the process that usually journalists don't reveal, right? I've got this information, now I've got that information. I'm not sure what this means. I'm not sure what that means. And Do you have any regrets about exposing yourself and revealing that?
No, I don't. I really don't. I mean, I think that this is what it means to do this job that we do. And if you really care about a story and you really care about the people in the story and you really care about getting it right and you care about being respectful, this is what it looks like, you know? And I think there's a lot of stuff out there in the world, just sort of like the pundit-y world that we live in, where certainty is so prized over everything else. And I don't feel that way. I don't feel that way about the world, I think.
Now, as the show became more successful, how did you feel about what this might mean for people like the victim's family, for people in the case who you at times drew suspicion towards as other possible suspects?
In terms of Heyman Lee's family, you know, we tried extraordinarily hard to contact them. First and foremost, just to make sure they knew what we were doing. I mean, the last thing we wanted was for them to find out some other way, not from us, you know. So absent their participation, I think what I had in my mind, honestly, every day was, you know, her family, her mom particularly, you know, just like, am I being respectful? Am I being respectful? Are we being respectful? And I think we just made sure. And I feel like we were as much as we could be. And then in terms of, did we ill-use other people? I don't think that we ever said anything in the podcast that wasn't said and way harsher in open court.
But it is a little different, right? Because these people are out there right now living their lives. They're not under suspicion, right? And the re-reporting of this and the re-airing of it essentially puts them back under suspicion.
Right. I mean, I think obviously the last thing I want is for someone to suffer, certainly unfairly, for the work that I'm doing. And again, I just feel like all I can say is I think something went wrong with this case. And I think that's worth reporting.
Today you released the final episode of the podcast, and this is just a spoiler alert or warning to fans who may be worried about spoilers that we're going to talk about it a little bit. But what conclusions did you draw about the case in terms of Adnan Syed's guilt or innocence?
Well, the main conclusion, I would say, is that based on the evidence presented in court, I think that that evidence was not what it seemed. And I think it was not strong enough to convict him.
Given all the time and energy that you've invested in the story, are you satisfied with the outcome?
Yeah. I mean, am I satisfied? I'm satisfied with our reporting. I really think that we tried everything we could try to work it out. You know, obviously, I wish I knew exactly what happened. I wanted to bring some clarity to what happened to this young woman. And I think the only thing we made clear is that it's not clear at all. And so, you know, yeah, I wish we'd found out the truth of it.
Well, Sarah Koenig, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.